This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Homelessness continues to be a problem in Greater Cincinnati on both sides of the Ohio River. The state of Kentucky was worst in the nation in the extent of child homelessness in 2013. And the number of sheltered individuals in Kenton, Boone, and Campbell counties increased by more than 60% in 2014. Joining us to discuss homelessness in Northern Kentucky are Northern Kentucky Area Development District Human Services Specialist Marion Scott, Emergency Shelter of Northern Kentucky Executive Director Kim Webb, Gateway Community and Technical College student Monica Smith, who has personally experienced homelessness, and Executive Pastor of the Next Chapter Church and Welcome House Northern Kentucky Board Member Aaron Broomall. And you can join our conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Monica, Aaron, Marianne, and Kim, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for having us.
Marianne, Aaron, can you give us some idea of the extent of homelessness in Northern Kentucky? What do the numbers say?
Well, I do have some information from the K count, which is the annual point in time count that HUD mandates for all the geographic areas to do a person by person literal count. And it's important to note probably, too, that this is just coming from one category of homelessness. There are four altogether, but this is just people who count as literally homeless. So homeless living on the street, homeless living in a shelter or in transitional housing. And as of January this year, which is when we did the K count, we had 327 people who were in that literally homeless category. And to break that down, about 50% of those were in shelter, but a full 37% were unsheltered. So that's a pretty sobering concept.
It is.
Definitely. As I look at it, looking from a I think what's important with those numbers are that is a point in time number. So it's on any given night in Northern Kentucky, we might have 327 people homeless. But over the course of a year, then that number can multiply as people move in and out of transitional housing or maybe find a room with a friend that night. Looking at some of the numbers that I find most compelling are looking at the numbers of children that experience homelessness throughout the year. And throughout Boone, Kenton, and Campbell County, over last school year, 2,100 students experienced homelessness at one point or in time or another between those three school districts, which to me is pretty astounding.
You know, when we say experienced homelessness, how do we define that?
Definitely. I think homelessness, the way that we define it is a lack of sustainable housing or lack of permanent housing. So it could be that you're literally living on the street, living in a car. It could be that you're temporarily sleeping on someone's couch or living with a family member. But housing that at any time could lead you to having nowhere to go, or you're literally in that position at the point in time. It can also be included in being housed in shelter at that period of time would include you as being homeless.
Right. And what's interesting is that when we talk about the point in time count for the emergency shelter, last winter we housed 477 individuals, and that was during the course of November to March. So the point in time count accounted for 327. So you can see the discrepancy in what everybody else is talking about. One night versus an entire year doesn't necessarily define homelessness in Northern Kentucky.
So the number could actually be a lot higher than what we realize?
Most definitely. Most definitely.
And it's challenging to get an accurate number, too. The K count is a great activity, but it's a group of volunteers one day going out and walking the street and finding anyone that would identify as homeless living outside and taking a count of them. That doesn't count people that might be living in abandoned buildings, people that might be living in cars, people that might for the moment be working a job but still be homeless that would not be included in that count. So the number is almost guaranteed to be higher, if not significantly higher than that number. Those are just the individuals that were met in shelter or out on the street that day.
And right. That's a really good point, too. I was going to say for the K count as well, we didn't get any volunteers to do the K count in the rural counties. So we don't have any data on the five rural counties of Northern Kentucky either. So that's something to keep in mind as well. And there are plenty of people who can't be located on that night, as Aaron and Kim were saying.
And we also have the transient. I know at some point we've had a discussion about the horse tracks. Those people are transient. They're technically homeless. They could, in effect, be counted for the point in time count. And they move from track to track.
Mm-hmm. Kim,
How is this affecting children? I mean, there are an awful lot of children that have experienced homelessness. How does this impact them?
I think it impacts, it has to start with a parent or a guardian of a child that cannot afford housing, either underemployment or can't afford housing, and then it just kind of spirals, and that's kind of where Welcome House steps in. We handle adults 18 and up with a Kentucky ID, but certainly those with kids, women and kids, we refer to Welcome House to handle that. We're not equipped to handle that service.
I think the childhood issue is definitely one of the things that makes me most passionate, because if we can help to bring stability to families, we can break down the cycle. And so I know one of the numbers for me that really had an impact on me is that a child who's homeless is likely to change schools up to 7 to 8 times per year and is usually 2 to 3 years behind their peers. And so you're creating this system where they're not creating self-value. They're not developing relationships. They don't have consistent educational instructors to help look after them and to help guide their development. And so it becomes a cycle. And it's often very, very often that it's not a parent that doesn't care. In fact, it can be a parent that cares very, very much, but they're making the decision between working and having an income and so that they can take care of the physical needs of the child or not working and therefore having other insecurities, because a single household income has to make almost twice the minimum wage to be able to afford a market rate apartment. And we can say, well, there's sub-market rate apartments out there, but for every 100 families that needs a below market housing unit in the United States, there's only 30 available. And so you have people cutting ends, working really hard, and my heart breaks for the families, it breaks for the kids, and it does create a cycle.
So education takes a big hit for these children. What are some of the other risks that they face?
I was looking through and I pulled some numbers on that. There's obviously health risks that go along with it. Often, if you look at the numbers for food instability, which means not enough money to provide proper nutrition or enough money to provide consistent meals, those numbers have consistently risen. And that's often the pull that families are feeling. Can I afford to pay my rent this month? Or do we pay for food? Or do we cut back and in essence, split the soup? And those numbers, they lead to health issues. They lead to just personal identity issues. We've all been young. We've all gone into school, and to go into school with the old and worn out clothes or the not new thing, we can call it silly, but it makes an impact on our friendships and relationships, as well as just being able to identify what their value is as they grow into adulthood and having that solid education.
Are they more likely to face mental health issues because you have this huge amount of insecurity of just not knowing what the next day is going to bring?
I would imagine so, and I think that probably affects education as well, not being able to focus on their schoolwork because they just don't really know where they're going to be. They don't know if their parents or if they're a mother and children and they're living with somebody and they don't know if that is going to last through the week or the weekend. Or I would imagine that instability affects most every aspect of their lives.
I tend to agree. I think one of the reasons I'm passionate about homelessness is because we have tons of issues going on throughout our community. We have issues with drugs. We have issues with childhood health. We have issues with giving kids good mentors. All of these things we have issues with. And to me, through everything I've done, providing housing stability can be one of the key factors in all of those issues. It just doesn't play into one. It impacts so many others.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us in this conversation. And let's get Monica in on this. Monica, you've experienced homelessness. I mean, how did that happen?
Well, I'm born and raised here in Cincinnati. I moved out of Cincinnati in 2006 to go stay with my sister. And then I moved back here in 2008 where I was staying with a friend. During the windstorm, if you all remember that, in 2008.
The remnants of the hurricane that came through, yeah.
Yes. my children and I were put out the night of the home of that storm. So, which led us to become homeless. But we were blessed also to have a place, another place to go, which was one of the shelters through St. John services. And we stayed there for a couple of months. And then we went out to Grace Place. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's here in Cincinnati as well. It's another homeless shelter for women and children. And we stayed out there for about 3 or 4 months before it caught fire. And we had to be put in, back at St. John's again. And we stayed there for about 3 or 4 months before we eventually got our own place in April of 2009. So it was a struggle because we didn't know what was going to happen on a day-to-day basis. You never think when you're in a shelter that a shelter catches fire and then you're back homeless again. You know, so that was just, you know, kind of, where are we going to go? What are we going to do? And, you know, where are we going to, you know, what's going to happen next? And I had my two children with me. And at the time, my daughter was going through some medical things, and we found out she had a medical condition called TRA1 malformation. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's where her brain stem was going into her spinal cord, causing her to have a lot of headaches and a lot of body pains, and she needed to get a surgery, which meant removing part of her skull. So we're in a shelter going through this, and I wanted to make sure that we had a place that was stable and that was clean because she was going to have this major surgery. And so there was a lot of factors, you know, me as a parent looking at my children saying, you know, like, I never imagined myself ever being homeless. I've never been homeless in all my life. We've always had a roof over our head. My mother has always provided a roof over our heads. And to be in this situation, not by my choice, it wasn't my choice to be homeless. It wasn't anything that I woke up and said, well, today I want to be homeless. I wasn't planning on my friend putting me and my children out of her home on one of the worst nights of the year, but it happened. But it was through God's grace and his mercy and his love for me and his protection of me and my children that he provided still a roof over our heads. And the only thing that I had that was valuable to me and it was strong was my faith and knowing that my God was not going to allow me to continue to be without a roof or my children to be without a roof or for us to be without food or clothing or the necessities that we need on a day-to-day basis.
Monica, how many children did you have and what ages?
I had two.
Two? Okay.
I have three children. And at the time my daughter was 14 and my son had just turned four.
Well, we'll talk with you some more about your story. It's compelling and it's interesting and it's great that you rose above it. We will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us to discuss homelessness in Northern Kentucky are Northern Kentucky Area Development District Human Services Specialist Marianne Scott, Emergency Shelter of Northern Kentucky Executive Director Kim Webb, Gateway Community and Technical College student Monica Smith, who, as we've been hearing, she's been through homelessness, and Executive Pastor of the Next Chapter Church and Welcome House Northern Kentucky Board Member Aaron Broomall. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Monica, how did your children, for the most part, how did they handle all this?
It was difficult. Like I said, my daughter was, you know, we had discovered, she, you know, found she had this medical condition. Mm-hmm. She had pretty much been an overall good student in school, straight A's and B's. You know, all through, you know, her school. It was embarrassing for her because she wasn't able to bring friends home because we didn't have a home, to be able to be in activities that were after school and sometimes she come back late became a problem because you had to be in the shelter by a certain time. So that was really frustrating for her, not being able to participate in after school activities because she had to be, you know, be at the shelter at a certain time. And it, you know, she went into a little depression, you know, being in the shelter. And like on the weekends, she would go stay with her grandmother while we were at the shelter. She would go stay with her grandmother. And so for her, it just, you know, her grades never dropped or anything, which was good. She always maintained her good grades at school. But like I said, it was just, you know, the embarrassment of us living in a shelter, you know, because I never thought or never saw ourselves living in a shelter or living in a shelter home.
Now, did you
and
go
as far as my? Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, did you go right from a shelter to an apartment at some point?
Yes, we did. Like I said, we after the place caught fire, we went into another back to St. John's, and we stayed there for about 2 or 3 months before we moved into our apartment that April 2009. And we've been, you know, we lived there for about 4 years until we moved into a house about 3 years ago.
So, Monica, what do you think was the turning point for you and your family?
The turning point was just really being determined not to be in that situation. It wasn't anything, like I said, we planned or ever saw being in that situation, but it happened. You know, this is my journey. This is my testimony that you can overcome those things. You just have to have enough determination and enough will to not be in that situation. And I can't speak for everybody. I can speak for myself. You know, being homeless is not a joke. It's, you know, you feel hopeless. You feel despair. You don't feel like anyone is in your corner. You don't feel like you have the support from family and friends that they say they will be there. They seem to kind of turn away from you because you're homeless, because they feel that you're needy and that you're going to need something, or you're going to ask them to come stay with them or things like that. So they kind of shun away from you when you're in that situation. And so for me, I had to make sure that we overcome these things, overcome being homeless by finding a place. And, you know, we were blessed in that aspect that we did find a place before my daughter had to have her surgery so that she could be comfortable. And so, you know, she had that done and everything was okay after that, you know.
So you finally did get into a permanent place and everything's going,
yes,
been going well since then.
Yes. Yes. And I got back in school. I was working at the time. And then I got started at Gateway 2014 in the summer, and I've been there since, honor student. And, you know, I work at the school as well, just started working there as a peer mentor to be able to help other students overcome their struggles. And if they're facing homelessness, give them some hope that it's not going to always be that way.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Very good, Monica. Marion, did you want to say something, Marion?
I was actually just going to ask you, Monica, were you able to access any kind of subsidized housing programs, or did you just from the shelter go to market rate housing?
I was getting ready to do a market rate apartment when the subsidized came up. And so I went with the subsidized apartment because even though at the time, you know, you in that situation where I think I can pull this market off. Realistically, I knew I really couldn't, but I knew I needed to get somewhere to get situated before my daughter had this surgery.
That's great to hear.
So I ended up going with the subsidized, so that way I wouldn't have to worry about how am I going to pay this rent or how am I going to do this. I could just relax and be at home with my daughter as she recovers.
That's great to hear. I was wondering, because I know sometimes that getting subsidized housing can really speed up the process of getting into a stable place. That's what we do at the Northern Kentucky Area Development District, is we have transitional housing right now, but we're going to broaden that to some permanent housing next year. So that's great to hear that worked out in your case.
It's different over here in Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. You know, being at the shelter, one of the shelters that we were at, the staff there, some of them were very nasty and very disrespectful, and made a lot of the females, the mothers that are there, cry and upset, and made them feel even worse than they did. But me being who I am, they couldn't break me in that manner. because you can't put me down or make me feel any worse than I already do. I only can do that for myself.
Well, plus you had that you had that determination going too, Monica, that kept you going, and that faith going. So those were both points in your favor.
Right, and we see that a lot
of to keep them encouraged.
And we see that a lot at the emergency shelter, too. Most people don't choose to be homeless. It's a difficult downward spiral to admit that you're homeless and to need the help and to get the help and to access services. It really requires the determination. We can provide some of those assistance and services, but it's really up to the individual to break the cycle. And Monica, you've done a fantastic job being a leader for your kids in your life to be successful and break it.
I think what's interesting is two things. In my experience, Monica's situation isn't unusual, but her drive, I see a lot too, that there is a lot of people that desperately don't want to be there, and yet they're thrown into a situation where getting from where they are to their goal is a huge unknown, and they don't know how to navigate the system. It is complicated. You do have to. If you don't have internet, it's hard to get online and find apartments that are available or find out what the next steps are, or even find out where you should go. So all those things are really complicated and hard. The second part is, for me, growing up in kind of a upper middle class neighborhood, I was really lucky. However, I did sleep on my grandfather's couch for a number of years, and it was only later in life that I realized, oh, geez, I kind of qualified for some of those things. But I was never aware of the extent of the problem in our community. I get kind of told myself the narrative, well, people that are homeless, they deserve to be homeless. They just don't work hard. They don't want to have a job. Or one thing or another as to why you are in. The more I've engaged and the more I've seen, it's been story after story of people that desperately do not want to be in that situation, desperately are willing to work as hard as they can to get out of that situation. They just need some help and assistance, like so many of us do when we fall into a place that we hadn't planned for.
Right. And a majority of our guests last winter, the average stay was 17 days. And this winter currently, 40% of people that report to the shelter are reporting with employment. And that is a huge telltale for us at the lack of affordable housing, the ability to have first and last month's rent, to be able to comfortably stay somewhere in secure housing is becoming quite the challenge. And people just need, a crash pad for a sense of time to be able to save that kind of money to be able to be successful.
And we'll continue our conversation about homelessness in Northern Kentucky. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Joining us to talk about homelessness in Northern Kentucky, our Northern Kentucky Area Development District Human Services Specialist, Marianne Scott, Emergency Shelter of Northern Kentucky Executive Director Kim Webb, Gateway Community and Technical College student Monica Smith, who has personally experienced homelessness, and Executive Pastor of the Next Chapter Church and Welcome House Northern Kentucky Board Member Aaron Broomall. You can join our conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Marianne, how much transitional housing is available in Northern Kentucky?
Well, through our program, we are able to support about 23 households at a time at any given time. So people will come in and go out. So we serve a lot more people within a grant year, but about that at each period in time. We also do a lot of supportive services with our transitional housing program. And what we're doing for our next grant year, which is 2016 to 2017, is we're breaking up the pretty substantial transitional housing program into three smaller programs, two of which are going to be permanent housing. So one's permanent supportive housing for the chronically homeless. One is rapid rehousing, which is another permanent housing program. And we're going to be able to increase the scattered site housing vouchers that we provide from about 22 to 23 up to around 40. So we'll have 40 families and individuals be able to be housed at the same time and get wraparound services so that they can increase their stability. So It's exciting times for
us. What are some of the other things that you're doing to help the homeless at your organization? What are some of the other services you offer?
Well, basically, what in particular at the Northern Kentucky Area Development District, we just administer grants to direct service providers who actually work with the clients or the participants. And we have some great partners that work with us. We have the Center for Independent Living Options, who specialize in people with disabilities. They do a great job. Women's Crisis Center specializes in working with domestic violence survivors and survivors of sexual assault. They also do a great job. I actually got my first experience, cut my teeth in homelessness understanding at the Women's Crisis Center, so it's a great place. And then we also work with Transitions, Inc., who does substance abuse concerns and addictions. They do a great job. And then also our last provider is Brighton Center, and they have a whole bunch of services that are supporting families in the community, like job readiness and education and life skills, tenancy, counseling. So we basically administer programs that people do directly with participants, and everybody is kind of has their own little speciality. Because like Monica was saying, her situation is specific to her, but you know, there's a diverse range of needs. There's a diverse population of people who find themselves in that position. So we want to make sure that we're offering a lot of different programs, a lot of different providers, a lot of people who have expertise in a lot of different areas.
Are there shelters in Northern Kentucky that will take an entire family, the dad, the mom, and the kids?
Not anyone right now.
Yeah.
We have the emergency shelter, which is, you'd be better to explain that, Kim. And
sure. We take any adult, 18 and up, man or woman in the winter with a Kentucky ID. In the summer, we run our summer recovery program, which is men only. And that is an opportunity for up to 30 men to live in the shelter, call it home, and work on their plan and their goals to end homelessness. And last summer, for example, we saw a record number take advantage. We treated and saw and helped 100 gentlemen, and of that, 74 ended up into permanent housing at the end. It takes them about 90 days. We also do work with Welcome House and access vouchers for our guests in terms of rapid rehousing. And for anybody who's not familiar, rapid rehousing is very valuable to a homeless individual that's trying to secure housing, because that rapid rehousing will cover first and last month's rent and a deposit, which is huge. If you're making minimum wage, that is a huge chunk that you would need to save. You would need to stay in a shelter a long time to be able to secure that.
Shelter's really complicated. Because you have such a large population of need that's there at any one given time. And so when you have space, you want to maximize the space to serve as many people as you can. But then that has to be done in ways that works as well as you can to keep everybody in the space safe, healthy, and able to succeed. And so the Welcome House has a structure, has a shelter, but we're able to just serve women and children. And it really is around that we have a limited space. We want to help as many as we can. And that means that we have families that might be sharing a room. We have kids in the same family or with their mother that might be sharing a bed. And when you bring in entire families, which I think all of our hearts would be, let's keep a family together. It's heartbreaking when you see a family have to be split up. But you take that we can house 30 people a night now, and you probably cut that to a third or less. If you figure once you have a whole family, they really need their own room for safety reasons, and bringing in an adult male and adult females and all those other things. It's really complicated. It's really, really hard to maximize the space.
Yeah. And especially in the winter right now, you know, we open our doors and below freezing, we'll take as many as we can get in the building. And a lot of times we'll see individuals that come, a woman will pass going to Welcome House to come into the shelter because we'll take men and women. Mm-hmm. Now she doesn't get a room with her husband or boyfriend or significant other. They're on separate sides of the hall. The fact is they'll sometimes they navigate the system to better suit their individual needs. You know, we've seen, I think, as of this point, you know, 169 individuals, unique individuals, access our services from November 1st. And so we're not even hit the coldest part of our year.
Yeah. What about, Aaron, in your case, how many people do you serve typically?
We served last year, 239 total individuals, and 225 of those received shelter for at least 3 days, and one-third of those were children.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. And Monica, just how difficult was it for you to ask for help when you first fell into homelessness? How tough a situation was that for you to have to seek out help?
It was really difficult, especially, you know, having children. You always want the best for your children, and you always want them to, you know, be okay and have their daily needs met. And I was, you know, at the time, was very prideful and, you know, keep to myself. Don't want people to know what the situation is, even though they know what it is. So it was really hard to really ask for the help and for anyone to help. And those I did ask, I, you know, did get help from, you know, which were my very close friends. And at the time, I could have stayed with one of them, but like I said, when the windstorm, they had to find places themselves. So I wasn't able to go stay with someone I knew that I could stay with until I got where I needed to be. And, you know, for people that's in shelters, you do have people that do take advantage. I've met women that were there that were taking advantage of the system because it was just like a way of life for them, because it's like a repetitive thing, the cycle not being broken. Their mamas did it, their grandmas did it, and so now they're doing it, and, you know, and it just goes on and on. And when speaking to them, it's like, where does it stop? Where do you, when did it get to the point where you don't want to be homeless anymore?
Yeah, that's an interesting point she brings up, Kim, about the breaking the cycle. How do you break the cycle? Because that seems like it'd be a common situation.
I think what we face when we have individuals that come to the shelter, and I agree with Monica, what we hear all the time is, you know, I never thought I'd be in this situation. You know, we kind of have a saying in the shelter that everybody is one paycheck away from homelessness. And so you can face any type of crisis in your life, personal, professional, economic, a health crisis. And, you know, Monica had several of those. You hit those, and it's a long downward spiral to needing to actually step in the door and get services. So it's just a challenge. It's for individuals, they have to have the want. That we can give them the skills to do it. We can provide them a place to call home, a mailing address, access to the phone, and give them a safe place to sleep on, and, you know, on a consecutive basis, especially in the summer, not so much in the winter when we're in emergency mode. But, you know, they have to want to do it. They have to have the drive to end it. And for some people, they're very successful.
Yeah, I think it goes along with also having the ability to have stability that's sustainable. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes, I think a model used to be get them in shelter, find them an apartment, and move them out. Well, what we find is that you might find an apartment that's affordable, but it's so poorly insulated that you get your first Duke bill of the year, and it's more than your rent, and
you can't afford it anymore.
No, and then you're making the decision: well, do I let the power go out, or do I pay my rent? And then I get evicted if I don't pay my rent, and then I can't get a new apartment because I've been evicted from the last one, and I have a massive bill from Duke, and so we are really focused on creating the things that create stability in the long term. And, you know, Monica is taking great advantage of what I think is one of the best resources we have in Northern Kentucky, which is Gateway Community and Technical College. They really have done a fantastic job at making adult education
affordable,
able to do it, putting the things around. They've really built a great system around individuals that are struggling with housing instability. And then between ourselves and the Brighton Center and a couple of other places, we have what are called scholar houses, which allows people to go to school and live based on an income that they can afford and continue to have stable housing while they further that education so that they can get a better paying job and afford to be able to create some own direction and have some stability for them and their kids.
We will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. My guests this afternoon are Northern Kentucky Area Development District Human Services Specialist Marion Scott, Emergency Shelter of Northern Kentucky Executive Director Kim Webb, Gateway Community and Technical College student Monica Smith, who has personally experienced homelessness, and Executive Pastor of the Next Chapter Church and Welcome House Northern Kentucky Board Member Aaron Broomall. If you'd like to join our conversation, the phone number is 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Will is joining us right now. Hi, Will. What's your question?
Okay, I was a volunteer at for the interfaith community at Erlanger Baptist Church. They put up people there. I'm sure both of your female guests there know the interfaith hospitality. And they put up families for a week. The parents would go through job training. They wouldn't be there during the day, and the kids would go to school, and then come back at night. And it was, a week at a time. It involved 50 people. So I'm saying, first of all, it's a powerful thing because about 15 volunteers were involved for this week-long effort, and that makes the community care more about what's going on. Mm-hmm. Because, 50 people, how many families and friends do they have? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to tell you, the other wonderful experience was there was a man there with three children, raising them on his own. He was determined, and I could tell he was going to make it. Later on, I heard that he did, through some of the other services, go ahead and get a job and get his life together, and his wife was in prison. So it's not just women. Occasionally you'll see something like that as a male. That was very powerful for me to see that and very rewarding.
Will, thank you so much.
Well, the question I want to ask
you is,
can they help interfaith at all if there's a budget for this? I mean, because it's very powerful when you have 55 people fixing them a meal every night. They take turns. Different churches were involved coming to Erlanger Baptist, so it was an interfaith thing. Is there any way that the state could support that? Because, getting that many people involved, more people care. And when it comes time when they're an ask for these different organizations, I think you're more likely to get private support and participation.
Okay, Will, thanks.
I really wish that was something that would happen as well because, when I was a parishioner at Immaculate Heart of Mary out in Burlington, we participated in this and did this and ran this out of our pastor's basement in his house. And it's a very worthwhile, enriching experience, and you keep the families together. I think there has been some discussion about reviving Interhospitality Faith Network in Northern Kentucky and having it be as powerful and as effective as it used to have been. I don't know where the status of those talks are, and I'm certain that they probably are looking at accessing government funding or grant money to be able to revive that program. Certainly would be helpful.
Yeah, our church participated, and I had a great passion for what they were doing there. The truth of the matter is, you talk about a dad with kids. We were discussing this before we came in. There is nowhere for them to go now. There are no shelters that will take a father and his kids. It's exceedingly challenging, and IHN was a great organization. I'm not familiar with what exactly happened as to why it wasn't sustainable at the time, but I think you're right. I think there's a huge heart of people that want to be there, that want to support, and just aren't sure how. And that was a great organization that helped people really get hands-on and answer the call to be hands and feet and to create relationships that make lasting change.
Well, and as well to help further the next generation of volunteers.
Absolutely.
The children that my kids that were involved in that program, it starts that service learning, that component to be compassionate to others. To start that at a younger age certainly helps.
Yeah. I think the other side of that coin, Will, is that it's not as convenient as what IHN made it to serve. That sounds negative. I don't mean it to sound negative. I think IHN did a great job at giving people a way to serve that was very accessible for them and comfortable. And I'd love to continue to see that. In the meantime, though, if your heart is for service, there are so many organizations in Northern Kentucky, the Emergency Shelter, Welcome House, Brighton Center, that need help on this. So I'd love if you could take that heart and, in the meantime, while we're still figuring out what's happening there, give that heart to organizations organizations that are still doing their best on these calls.
Yeah, and Will, honestly, we would be open. You know, we're successful in our winter when we have overflow. We need overflow when we can no longer have the capacity in our building. We rely on churches and organizations to do that for us. First Church of Christ in Burlington actually is an overflow location. I would love to talk to you about Erlanger Baptist becoming part of that for us. So if you'd like to reach out to me, you can find my contact information on our website or through the program at the end of this when we finish here today.
And there's a link to Kim's website as well at WVXU.org, so you can find it there as well. Sarah sent us an email, and she says she went through a period of homelessness. She had a good job, was downsized. The landlord raised the rent. Suddenly, there she is. She's homeless. And she has a son who's 15 years old. And her point is that this can happen to anyone. This can happen to someone with a college degree. This can happen to someone with a good job.
Absolutely. I mean, I've only been with the shelter since the end of June, and one of my first conversations was talking with a guy, a graduate who actually comes back to volunteer in our summer shower program, and got to talking to him, and he was name-dropping some people from the college, and I realized that he had graduated from Morehead State University, the very campus I walked on, and a life turn of event, you know, had him homeless, lost his job, lost his wife. She took everything from him. And, you know, that's what transpires. Life happens.
Yeah, I think we all love to live under the illusion that we're independent. But in truth, we all depend on people all the time. And it just happens in different ways. And sometimes it's a bad choice. We all make bad choices. Some of us are lucky enough to have people that will bail us out when that happens. But not everybody has that gift. And sometimes it's not even a choice that you make. It's something that was made for you or happened to you, whether it be a health scare, whether it be domestic violence, which happens all the time, unfortunately. All sorts of things cause this. It's individuals. You can't put it in a nice, easy basket and wrap it up. It comes from all walks of life and all different backgrounds.
And challenge people to rethink homelessness, because definitely, I think if we honestly sat down and talked about what the definition of homelessness, every one of us that's listening could identify someone that they know currently in their life that's homeless, couch surfing, hopping from friends to family, living out of their car, you know, living in a motel, a week to week motel. You're homeless.
Yeah, I was going to say too that that's part of what the K count statistics don't get. I think in 2010 was the last year that I'm aware of that they did any kind of data gathering on people who are precariously housed, which is like doubled up or, you know, in substandard housing where they didn't have enough, basic facilities, and there was 495 households back then. So who knows what it is now?
Wow.
Exactly.
Well, Monica, Aaron, Marianne, and Kim, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you for hosting.
The next Northern Kentucky Forum is going to be on December 10th. It'll be taking a look at the issue of homelessness in Northern Kentucky. And you can find a link to more information at WVXU.org. Joining me this afternoon, Northern Kentucky Area Development District Human Services Specialist Marianne Scott, Emergency Shelter of Northern Kentucky Executive Director Kim Webb, Gateway Community and Technical College student Monica Smith, and Executive Pastor of the Next Chapter Church and Welcome House Northern Kentucky Board Member Aaron Broomall. Your plant may eventually be able to power your devices. WVXU's Ann Thompson talks with a UC graduate about his cyborg rose. Here's Focus on Technology.
Elliot Gomez, who got his PhD in electrical engineering at the University of Cincinnati, has now developed an electronic plant. He joins us from Sweden, where he's perfecting it. Thanks for joining us, Elliot.
Hi, thank you.
What's involved in putting wires in a plant?
So it's actually a lot easier than you might think. And so you might remember the experiment that you do as a kid, where you can take a rose or a carnation, a white carnation, and put it in food coloring, and the plant soaks it up and can even change the leaves and or change the plant to a different color. And so we use a very similar method here, but with electronics, it's not so simple. It requires changing a lot of the recipe that we use so it doesn't either clog the plant or kill it, because we're actually giving it conducting material in a water solution. And so after many attempts by our chemist here, he was able to find a recipe that actually worked for the plants. And the plants not only liked it, but also helped assemble this wire inside the plants and this transistor inside the plants.
Why would somebody want to do this?
So there's a lot of different questions of why we might want to do this. And the main reason is we don't know a lot about, we don't have a lot of tools to study plants and to interact with them. Plants work on a much slower time scale than we're normally used to operating on. And so by essentially giving the plants a central nervous system, if you will, or a way to plug it in or to interface with it, with traditional electronics, not only can we might be able to monitor the plants or regulate plant hormones, we might even be able to tap into some things the plants are really good at, like producing energy or harvesting energy from the sun through photosynthesis. The agriculture industry is, starving for tools to be able to control plant physiology, such as, making a plant bloom or increasing its yield or maybe delaying it. If a frosty weather is coming in, we could maybe delay the flowering of a plant and maybe save it. So I guess in short, we don't exactly know the application right now, but there's a lot of potential to expand this field just by having more tools available for us and electronic tools.
And does it produce energy? And if so, how much?
Well, it doesn't produce energy right now. So we were able to demonstrate wires or conducting wires, and also transistors. So this is the basic foundation for a sensor or computer logic, if you will. And so we aren't able to produce energy yet. But obviously that's something that we have our sights on, because that could be a very big game changer for the energy industry.
And when that time comes, possibly how much energy could it be?
That's a very difficult question to answer right now. But I would say we can at least look at being able to power the plant itself. So if this plant has a sensor, it's obviously going to need a battery or a power supply. So at minimum, we'd want to be able to self-sustain the electronics that are already in this plant.
How long before the cyborg rose or any other plant you might use becomes common?
Well, that's a good question. There's a lot of different steps that we have to take until we can actually, start growing cyborg roses in our garden. We need to be able to produce more sensors and learn a lot more about the plant and how it reacts to these different electrical circuits inside of it. We need to work in tandem with the plant. We don't want to just stick a wire in it, but actually work with the plant to do what we want it to do. And so we're quite a ways away, but this is the first big step in a new direction where we actually integrate electronics and plants together to see what we can do.
Elliot Gomez, former UC researcher, now in Sweden developing electronic plants. Ann Thompson, 91.7 WVXU.
Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier, the assistant producer, Belinda Kai, and the technical director was Rick Andres. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now, coming up next on 91.7 WVXU.